everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story Is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality they see underneath it all.
That's right. And this week, it's episode number 49, coming at you in 48 frames per second 3D.
It's extra smooth and kind of video looking, I understand.
We're talking about The Hobbit today, but I have not yet seen the movie. We're talking about the book. Have you seen the movie, Julie?
No.
Okay. So neither of us have seen the movie, so
yeah.
It's a little bit of a question mark for us still. But the movie is partially why I picked it, you know, as most of the people on the internet are reading it.
Yes. The ones we know.
Yeah, after I picked it, I started to see it everywhere. You know, I didn't expect to be unique, but, you know, I think we'll be unique in how we talk about it anyway, but we'll see.
I think so, or at least somewhat unique, because I'm surprised at how many people have talked about it on Goodreads.
Mm-hmm.
One person whose reviews I follow gave it 4 stars because they were so thrilled by the book, which they had never read. They said they could see how their children were just going to love it, and they knew their kids would give it 5 stars. And they said, but me as a grown-up, I give it 3 stars, so I'll meet in the middle. And I was like, What do you mean you as a grown-up give it 3 stars? And they were saying, because, you know, I'm not into fairy stories. And I thought of, was it C.S. Lewis who said, you're not yet old enough to read fairy stories again? Like, you know, when you get older, you can appreciate them again.
Man.
And
you know,
thought, you're not old enough.
One of the really nice moments of my life, I was at college and at the University of Arizona. And, you know, I went through a period. You know, as you get older, you know, you hit about 18, or at least I did. I started to think, well, I need to be getting serious. And I shouldn't be doing this silly stuff anymore, whatever it might be, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And to the University of Arizona comes Ray Bradbury. He gives a talk. And in his talk, he talked about how he went through that very same thing. And he threw away all his comic books. I mean, he actually got rid of all this stuff.
Oh.
And how he got so incredibly depressed.
Oh, yeah.
And he realized that all the people that were telling him to do that were not the people that he needed to be listening to. So he started to collect them again, and only then did he start to wake up and start to feel like everything's worth everything, mm-hmm. you know? That was a big moment. So I'm just saying that, don't get rid of your stuff. You're never too old.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the stuff. I mean, because there's nothing wrong with it. It's
there's nothing wrong with
else
it at all.
Judging it.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that makes me think, thanks to you picking The Hobbit, and I then went and listened some to the Tolkien Professors podcast, which got me more interested in the broader range of Tolkien's writing. And he's written a book.
Yeah. I really appreciate you telling me about that. I've heard of the Tolkien Professor before, but I listened to several of the lectures. I didn't get through all of them in time, but I thought he was terrific.
Yeah, he's really good, I think, at synthesizing a lot of the real basic concepts and just kind of, without telling you exactly what to think, but kind of opening up your mind to what the book can contain for you. And he did it with the short stories, which I'd never really appreciated very much. So then I went back and read them, and I could see them afresh. And when I was looking around for samples of his book on Kindle, I came also across, you know, all these other books that people have written. And what amazed me is that Tom Shippey has written this book called J.R.R. Tolkien, Author of the Century, which was interesting to me. But the connection for me was that I remember when the Wall Street Journal a year or so ago started having Saturday be a special books section. And someone said, oh my gosh, they're really serious. They're going to have a regular science fiction book column by Tom Shippey. And I had no idea who this guy was. I was like, well, okay. Then I find out he took over after J.R.R. Tolkien taught his curriculum in philology for a long time, has kind of striven to kind of help elucidate the way Tolkien thought about the stories he was writing through words. And I mean, just all this stuff. And I was like, oh, I never understood who this guy was before. So it's funny. I feel like I'm just been dipped into this huge vat of Tolkien goodness.
Wow, that's neat. That's neat.
That's great. So thank you.
Oh, yeah. I used to have, well, I say used to have. We moved. you know. Mm-hmm. I still have books in boxes in the storage unit. So somewhere in there is a book on my to-read list, which is fairly large, but it's called Tolkien and the Great War that I bought long ago. And I'm eager to, you know, even now, especially having gone through this again. And then another book that I have read that I'm actually going to read some from today is The Inklings by Humphrey Carpenter.
And you've mentioned that book a lot. I guess I should read that book.
It's really, really worthwhile. There is an audio version. I don't know if it's still on Audible or not. It's kind of an old audio version.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the author is Humphrey Carpenter. Okay. And The Inklings, just in the description, it says, "There goes C.S. Lewis. It must be Tuesday. Must have been uttered more than once as Lewis was spotted entering his favorite Oxford pub, The Eagle and Child, locally referred to as The Bird and Baby, with J.R.R. Tolkien, Charles Williams, and their friends. They gathered there once a week for beer, and on Thursday evenings they would go to Lewis's rooms at Magdalen College to talk philosophy and read aloud from the books they were writing at the time. Together they were known as the Inklings."
Yeah, man, and, that must have been so much fun.
Oh, man, it's great. And, you know, sometimes I think, man, I would really love to do that. But, you know, what are we doing here?
Well, I was just thinking that.
We're doing this in the SFF audio. SFF audio is the Inklings.
Yeah, that's the same thing. I was like, you know, that the only thing that would be better is if we all lived near each other and we would meet a couple nights a week.
Yeah, exactly.
And, with a beer.
Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly.
That, there's a podcast for you. Everybody grab your favorite beverage and turn on the mics and let's record.
And just talk. Oh, well, yeah, maybe nobody'd want to listen.
Or I doubt it.
I don't know.
You know, early on in podcasting, I think old Evo Terra, they used to do something like that.
They did, I think, that round table thing.
Yeah, and I remember I listened to it a couple of times, but it got a little too raunchy for me.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
But we digress.
Just a different crowd. I was going to say, but we need to talk about The Hobbit itself.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do.
I listened to the audio, and I had told you, and I can't remember if I mentioned it here. I didn't think it was the best reading I've ever, well, not that I've ever heard, but that I could imagine.
Rob Inglis was the narrator.
Yeah, I know he's the official approved one, and it's unabridged, and that's fine. And I did go on and start listening to The Fellowship of the Ring, which is a much improved reading, I think.
Oh, that's nice.
The voices are all
enjoyed
much
him.
Closer.
You know, he sings the songs and everything. And, you know, I wonder if Tolkien provided any music or if just kind of made it up as he went.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know either. But
yeah, that's why I listened to the audio, because I really have a tendency to skip long poetry and any songs. So I wanted to make myself listen, because I knew those were really important to Tolkien and any storytelling he did. And that was really valuable.
Yeah. Yeah, it was.
And now I'm rereading it, because there's something about just seeing the words on the page. I'm liking it so much better this time through.
Yeah, I read it out loud to my daughter about a year and a half ago.
Oh.
And then I listened to it in preparation for this.
And okay.
Yeah, so I listened to that Rob Inglis version as well. You know, one thing that I've had forever, but I never have listened to, is the audio version. Or I'm sorry, audio drama version.
Oh.
They've got I think that they have two.
Is
one
it
from the
from
BBC?
BBC.
Yeah, one from the BBC and one from NPR. So it's like an American version and a British version.
Are they allowed to do it with American accents? Because it just doesn't seem
I'm
right.
I'm sure that the American version has British accents anyway.
Oh, okay,
yeah,
thank
I'm
goodness.
Sure of it. Yeah.
Well, I guess. I guess everybody knows the story of The Hobbit. Do we need to do any summary at all?
We ought to summarize it a little bit, you know,
just
for those who are interested.
Maybe.
Yeah. Yep,
quick
let's do. Mm-hmm. So there's Bilbo. Bilbo Baggins. What's
he's
the first
a
line in the, you know, there, once there was a hobbit or something like that?
Yeah, that's he said in his letters, J.R.R. Tolkien did, is he was grading exams and it was really boring. And somebody had left a whole page free, and he just scribbled down the first line. In a hole in the ground, there lived a hobbit.
There it is.
And then he thought he'd better keep writing. So, not a nasty, dirty, wet hole filled with the ends of worms and an oozy smell, nor yet a dry, bare, sandy hole with nothing in it to sit down on or to eat. It was a hobbit hole, and that means comfort.
Yeah, yeah.
And that right there tells you a lot.
Right. And I think it's important to mention, you know, for anybody who's not familiar, The Hobbit, he wrote The Hobbit before he wrote Lord of the Rings. So The Hobbit came out. Was it that long? Yeah, The Hobbit came out in like 37. Is that right? Mm-hmm. 1937. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I didn't look up when Lord of the Rings came out, but I'm sure it was a long time.
By Auden that I was reading to you from was from 1956, I think.
Ah, okay.
For the last book. So
right. So yeah, it took him a good long time to write Lord of the Rings. But there's a big difference in tone from The Hobbit to Lord of the Rings in print. So yeah. The Hobbit is really written for kids. It's a really fun book. Even when things get tense, he's talks about it lightly. Mm-hmm. You know,
it's got some really funny scenes.
Yeah,
in it.
He'll make up words and things and throw them in there to make it, you know, silly in a little way. Mm-hmm. Almost like just, you know, this isn't so bad. You know, just throw a word in there for the kids, or whatever. But it really is enjoyable. But it's a terrific book. And then Lord of the Rings, on the other hand, as I was preparing for this podcast, and I don't have a way to quote where this came from, but in one of the things I looked at, it said that at one time he was writing Lord of the Rings, and he actually told the publisher, whoever, he said, "This is much darker than The Hobbit was." And this may not work for you at all, you know, but I'm going to go ahead and keep going.
Because they wanted a sequel.
Right.
Started writing it. And that's one of the things that connected with, I had heard it since I've been dipping into all kinds of places. I'm not sure exactly where this came from, but it might be this J.R.R. Tolkien author of the century book. But he started off to write a sequel to The Hobbit, and the story kind of took off on its own.
Yeah.
For instance, when they get to, just to leap ahead, but when the hobbits get to the inn at Bree, he's like, suddenly this guy started talking from a corner. I didn't know who he was or what he was going to say. Well, that was Strider.
Oh, that's neat.
So that thing that happens to authors. And Leaf by Niggle, that short story, is a lot kind of about that sort of a thing, where you're being very creative, but a lot of time the creative impulse takes you in places that you don't actually expect. And it can pull things from you that surprise you.
Wow. Yeah.
You know, when Niggle is painting his leaves and sticking them on his tree and painting this amazing tree, and he doesn't really know where the tree came from. You know, later he actually sees the tree.
Yeah.
So there's this kind of symbiosis, and that kind of makes the tree real, and it feeds his art, and he's feeding the tree, and the way the story works. And that's kind of, people have said they think that's how he kind of thought about his writing also.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've got a book, Tree and Leaf, that has that in it. Mm-hmm. It's got an essay or two in it as well. Kind of about mythology and his thoughts about mythology.
Yeah, doesn't it have that essay on fairy stories?
Yeah, that's it, on fairy stories, right.
Yeah, because he's defending them. People are saying kids shouldn't read fairy stories, and he's saying, no, these are very necessary for everybody, but especially for kids.
That's one of the things I caught from Professor Olson, was that Tolkien seems to be using the word fairy and the word elf as interchangeable. Mm-hmm. That was an, you know, so...
Yeah, it's not a Tinkerbell fairy story This is about them as, you know, those really older mythical stories where people would be afraid to go out after dark near certain hills because people would disappear and never come back again, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Those kind of myths that would go around the English countryside where they were kind of a wild, different folk. And so he thinks of them, although more noble.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kind of like that, instead of, you know, what they've been turned into in more modern culture, like by Disney or whatever.
Right. Yep.
But yeah, one day Bilbo the Hobbit, who's not quite, they're little people, and they're not exactly people, but they're pretty close to being people.
Mm-hmm.
He's sitting outside his hobbit hole, and up comes this old man and starts talking to him, and it turns out it's the wizard Gandalf.
Gandalf the Grey.
Gandalf the Grey, or as the British all say it, Gandalf. And I'm like, what?
That's funny. I was just by sheer coincidence about an hour ago, the Colbert Report was on TV.
Mm-hmm.
And the guest was the guy who played Gandalf. Why is his name escaping? Sir
Ian.
Yeah, Ian McKellen. Ian McKellen. Right.
Yeah, McKellen. Yeah.
Yeah, I love that guy. He's great. The Homer's Odyssey. I listened to that and read it at the same time. So, but he narrated it. He said, Colbert being as funny as he is and says, wasn't it a demotion for you to go back to playing Gandalf the Grey? And he said, no, I didn't like Gandalf the White very much because he's not as fun. He's a Gandalf the Grey, he can have a smoke and he can eat, and then Gandalf the White was all regal and everything and always so serious. But
he doesn't joke. Yeah, I know. He's not blowing smoke rings and turning them different colors and exactly. making them go in and out of each other. And so he sits down, they have a smoke, and basically Gandalf leaves and says, well, I'm going to come for tea tomorrow and something like that, right?
Yeah. And then
Bilbo, after a while, was going, no, you can leave. Get out of here. I don't want to talk to you anymore. You're making me very uncomfortable. Because he wants somebody to join in an adventure. That's it.
The Hobbit likes comfort.
Yeah.
That's what he tells himself anyway. But he's got this part of himself, the Took part, that likes adventure.
The disreputable part of his family. And he says, we're playing quiet folk and have no use for adventures. Nasty, mm-hmm. disturbing, uncomfortable things make you late for dinner. I can't see what anyone sees in them. That's what he says. And so then he's like, good morning, get out of here. And so he goes inside and Gandalf puts a secret sign on his door. And the next day for tea, up at one and two at a time, show up a bunch of dwarves who just start barging in as if they know everything in his pantry. And he's got to serve them tea and dinner and... Mm-hmm. Then they start talking about the adventure, which is that they had a mine, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And they were driven out of it by Smaug the dragon.
Right.
Who killed all the people in the nearby town and drove the dwarves out. And they need a burglar to help them get back in, figure out the secret way back in and get all their treasure. And Gandalf has said, Mr. Baggins is a burglar, and that's about the time when
Mr. Baggins.
Yeah, sometimes in there he starts screaming and lying down and going, struck by lightning, because he can't handle it, it's just...
Yeah.
If I was a kid, I would just have been laughing my head off.
Oh, man. And then Gandalf says something like, he is a burglar, or he will be when the time comes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then later they're complaining because they're like, he looked like a grocer bobbing up and down on the mat. Bilbo overhears this. And he's like, I say he's a burglar. And if I say he's a burglar, he's a burglar. Now, I see value in him. You just take him and use him.
Yep. Yeah.
That's later in the adventure.
Right. Right.
And so.
And then, he reluctantly joins, right?
Yeah. The rest so of he's, the.
And that was an. Did you ever see the 13th Warrior? There's a lot of. I just read Beowulf. Did a podcast about Beowulf, so it's funny.
I haven't heard it yet, but it's ready and it's in my
book. So, but there's Beowulf in this, in The Hobbit, very clearly. What's the guy's name who lives in the cave who did the riddle?
Oh, Gollum.
Gollum, gosh, of course.
Yeah.
This is going to be a great podcast if I can't remember Gollum's name.
When we can't remember Gollum's name, we're in big trouble.
But Grendel and Gollum are very similar.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Grendel was a big monster-ish
It depends on your interpretation, but he's in a cave. He's sitting there in the cave, and he gets disturbed by their partying, which is why he comes out in the first place. But he's just sitting in there. Being Grendel, and then so anyway.
Okay. Well, and that's what people would say is that's because Tolkien's background was in philology, meaning,
J.R.R. Tolkien actually wrote, Beowulf itself was, there was only one version of this, and people were kind of discounting it, saying, well, it must not have been very important because...
Right.
Clearly, they weren't. Copy. There wasn't like 100 of these. People weren't writing this down all over the place like they were the Odyssey or something. And then J.R.R. Tolkien wrote an essay in which he basically changed everybody's mind. It's almost universal everybody all of a sudden agrees that this is a great work of art because of how he described it. He's the guy. Yeah, he's the guy who did that.
I wonder if that's in that book called Monsters and Critics, and it's a bunch of his essays and critical works like that.
Yeah, sure could be. Sure could be.
Yeah, well, and he did a translation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of Beowulf, and then he started, and here's the thing, there's a book, for anybody who doesn't know, called The Silmarillion.
Yeah,
Silmarillion. Which is this huge, long history of all this stuff, right? The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings come from it, but the thing that's like important about it is, if you're like me, and you heard about it because it was published after The Lord of the Rings, because people might be interested, and I understand it's super hard to read, but you think he wrote it afterwards, like as a justification or going on with it. And what really the deal is he was doing it already because that was his passion and his hobby and he loved it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then he stopped to write The Hobbit. So there are roots of The Hobbit that come from the Silmarillion because that's where he was at in the book. And he was using kind of that, which of course came from Beowulf and all that other stuff he'd studied.
All that mythology and everything. Yeah.
Yeah. And then he went back to, and he was like, oh, I'm done with that. Okay. Now back to the Silmarillion in my spare time.
Yeah.
So he's working away on this and then he's got to do the sequel. Well, then he does The Lord of the Rings. Well, that is from, he's written more of the Silmarillion. It's more developed. He's thought through some other things, so it's got a different tone. Also, he wrote the first one for his kids who were younger. Now his kids are a lot older.
Mm-hmm.
There's all these things that factor into it. And then when he was done with The Lord of the Rings, he's like, oh, great. Oh, I'm a superstar now? That's interesting. Okay, back to the Silmarillion. You know, you just can't wait. So it was kind of interesting to me because in terms of, that was his great passion. And these other things came from it, but they were never designed to be bestsellers. In fact, they weren't even done in a way that would make them best designed that
way.
Sure,
sure. Yeah.
But it's because he knew Beowulf and loved it. And that was, you know, all that stuff that it turned into something that struck this inner core in people that they resonate with in terms of story.
Right.
Which doesn't tell us.
Have you seen The 13th Warrior?
Uh-uh. Oh, no, that's what started us off. Yeah,
no, but that's a great movie. I really enjoyed it, but it's almost a telling of Beowulf by Michael Crichton, who did, you know, wrote Jurassic Park and all that. It's from a novel called Eaters of the Dead by Michael Crichton.
Now,
it's basically a Viking saga of a movie.
Okay.
And the 13th warrior is this Arabic guy who's played by... I will not remember a single name in this podcast, but if it comes to me.
But isn't that based on a real thing that happened? Some Arab guy who went up to the, I mean, and wrote.
I'm not sure if it has roots in reality or not. But I thought it was interesting that, you know, in here we have dwarves. There was 13 dwarves and they needed a number 14.
For luck.
Yeah. And in the 13th warrior, they had 12 and had to have a 13th. Which is why the Arab came in the first place. He was just visiting, and they said, hey, you're number 13. And he's like, what?
Yeah. Get in here.
Really, I love that movie. I think it's neat.
Oh, well, I'll have to definitely look for it.
It's fun.
Well, because in The Hobbit, what happens is I'd forgotten that, and that's hugely important. Luck is so important in this book, which I didn't realize until reading it through. And then also, if you listen to the Tolkien professor's series of lectures, he points it out again and again. And part of the reason that makes it so interesting for Scott and me is J.R.R. Tolkien was a devout Catholic.
Yeah.
And he didn't, you know, go around putting anything into his book. But, you know, if that's what your worldview is, you're grounding things in the way you see the world. And the thing I love about it is the luck in the book is not really necessarily luck the way we think about it. It's that you can't see the bigger picture and the way things are set up, that when you do your part, you're in the place that you need to be so that the plan can work out.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to do it. That's the free will part. But, you know, Bilbo is incredibly lucky. You know, he when they're having their adventure, the first big thing that happens is it's raining and they want something to eat. I guess it's not really raining, but they want something to eat and they see a fire and they send him to sea and it's these three trolls who haven't had a decent bit of man flesh, and I don't know when. They're stuck eating mutton, you know, and they're complaining about it. They're wonderfully low class. Yep. They're so great. And but when there's this big fight, Bilbo, by accident, picks up this key. Well, he just happens across it and picks it up. And so when they're trying to find their way after the trolls are dealt with, they're trying to find their way into the troll cave. And he's, oh, here, I've got this key. And it's got these two very important swords that are very helpful in fighting and are so well known that they've got their own names, which Tolkien is all about naming things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And your name means a lot. It means it helps define who you are as well as you know, giving you something to call it.
Yeah.
So, which I thought was interesting because when Bilbo keeps being called a burglar, much later on in the book, when he's in the dragon's lair and he takes the Arkenstone, spoilers everywhere, by the way, guys, and he takes the Arkenstone, he's like, well, now I really am a burglar. And I'm like, oh my gosh, he finally became what he was called.
Yeah.
He'd been working toward it ever since he tried to pick the troll's pocket.
And failed.
And he failed, yeah. But that was only because he didn't know that trolls' purses talk.
That's right.
And he went, whoa, what are you then? And they were like, what?
Oops. Yeah, that worked.
Yeah, but yeah. So the great thing about the story, like any great kid's story, is it's progressing. So you see Bilbo's growth in getting better and better at helping everybody out.
Mm.
And it gets a little more dangerous as it goes. You're kind of working your way into the world and you know how things, you know, are going to happen.
Yeah.
But what I never noticed, and again, thank you, Tolkien Professor, is it didn't occur to me that really the dwarves do very little and they have almost no plan. You think of them as kind of being in charge and
that is really
we've got
true,
this
isn't it?
Plan
yeah,
and
Thorin,
we just need you to
Thorin,
do this
one
part.
You think he's the man, you know?
Yeah.
He's the guy. But he's doing it all. But you're right. He really isn't.
No.
He's just kind of going along, you know, and
right.
All right, Hobbit, go do this for us now.
Yeah, exactly. Go find out about this. And the only time they don't do it is if he can't maybe do it. He's not big enough to do it or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Bilbo's the one who, when they're sleeping in that cave, he's the one who wakes up when the goblins are stealing the ponies.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one who has to stay hidden. Or he's the only one who can get up to see above the trees. He has to do all this so he can see when they're trying to get the boat across the Mirkwood River, you know, and trying to snare it. He's the only one who can see if they're really doing it or not. He's when they're captured by the elves, he's the one who's hiding because of his magical ring and getting everybody out. They're kind of just along for the ride, really, until they get to the village or the old town of Dale. And Thorin starts talking so grandly, and everybody goes, oh, we remember the dwarves. We were all rich then.
Yes.
And what do? They march up to the mountain, and then they go, okay, burglar.
Yeah, that was kind of a funny moment. You know, Thorin's like, hey, you know, we really appreciate everything that you've done for us that we really haven't asked you to do, but now the time has come for you to do what we brought you here for. And he's like, oh, all right. But, you know, his attitude has changed over that whole period. You know, he's gotten more confident, the Hobbit.
Yeah
Bilbo.
Yeah.
He's like, wow, maybe I can do this. So just like Gandalf said, by the time it was time, he's a burglar. Yeah.
Yeah, and what I think I like about the way it starts to give him some confidence, and even though he doesn't really do anything, but I mean, you know, when he's listening to the trolls talk, any normal person would have snuck away and gone, there are trolls there. Let's go somewhere else. And he says, well, I'm supposed to be a burglar. I guess I should start sometime. I'll do it now. And he fails. And, you know, but because he made that start, he keeps being forced into situations where he's got to he can choose action or run away. And he starts to get braver, because that wasn't necessarily as brave to me as when he gets away from Gollum. He gets away from the goblins and everything. He's jumped through and lost all his buttons on the door, back door out of the mountain. And he can't find anyone. He doesn't know where any of the dwarves are. And he suddenly says he's starting to get that horrible, uncomfortable feeling he might have to go back inside and look for them. And he had just decided that's what he was going to do. And then he hears her voices. And I was like, and that was that internal moment of, for him, of, okay, I don't want to do this, but it's what I need to do. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
You start getting to see a little bit of his internal workings, and he'll do that. He'll, oh, I don't want to do this, but okay. How am I going to do this? How am I going to get him out of this elf thing? How am I going to, you know?
Yeah.
And he starts taking braver and braver actions.
Which, I think is one of the major themes of the book, I think. You mentioned the luck and how that's kind of, you know, luck may not be the right word for it, but there are things similar that we experience throughout our lives. And and then Bilbo being brave and gaining in bravery throughout the whole thing is maybe like a model for us.
Yeah. Through small actions, just because you've got to do something and it's the right thing to do. And I was telling you, here comes my true Catholic nerd moment. my Catholic science fiction or fantasy nerd moment. Because I was really influenced by Leif by Niggle, because I really kind of liked that idea of we all have something, some little thing that we're perfect at, and you may just be a little fellow, but that was what you could do, and that'll be understood. That's kind of part of the point of the story. And it doesn't let you off the hook for the things you didn't do, but you know, you get credit for it. And so I was kind of processing that, and then I was reading about, you know, Bilbo and the trolls and him. I don't know why it was for me that really kind of crystallized a moment when the thing that I have, you know, we have these things we're supposed to do and we kind of just ignore them. We all have these things we should do and we just kind of ignore them. And one of mine was, my mother-in-law's nearby. She's in a nursing home. The family doesn't get a chance to visit her very much because we're all at work. And I would go, I have my own mother to call. You know, this is Tom's mother. Mm-hmm. Well, but she really likes me. She likes all the daughter-in-laws. She only had sons, and she was really happy when she had some daughter-in-laws finally, you know. And so I know that she would really like it if I went and visited, but she's got some dementia. She doesn't always recognize you or respond. It's very awkward. Everybody hates it because it's not really her, and but you know you need to do it, you know. So I finally, somehow I was listening to that, and I just went, you know what? If little Bilbo, and me thinking about Tolkien telling this story in a different way than just a kid's story, more as a, this is kind of our progress, a little pilgrim's progress through life in a sense, you know, and for a worldview. And I went, you know what? Okay. So I try to pull out the troll's purse and it talks and I get caught and I look stupid and okay. So I started looking up online and I was like, I'm going to go see her tomorrow. I'm going to start going to see her at least twice a week. I'm not going to make my husband have to go with me because I can get away more often. And I found a thing about reading to people with this condition and this and that. And I was like, oh, great. I'm going to have to read to her. Okay. That I could do that. I've been podcasting. I can do that. And so I got the Gift of the Magi and I got some big pictures that I printed out and I went and showed them to her. And then I read the story and here we are in the TV room with all these older people who are all either dozing or, you know, not hearing me very well. And everybody walking by looking, staring at me. And I started to leave because I'd shown the pictures and I'm not kidding to you. At that moment, I pulled out the Kindle with the Gift of the Magi because I went, oh, I should read. And I was like, I am going to sound like a fool. And I was like, no, just like Bilbo. So what if you're stupid and crazy, just do it anyway. And I was like, okay, God, this is on you. I'm doing it anyway. And do you know she, because I was at her eye level, and do you know she suddenly, when I started reading, she suddenly focused on me and stared into my eyes the whole time.
Wow.
And I got done and they said, because my whole deal was, I was like, don't need her to pay attention. I'm just going to do what I think I'm supposed to do. And they showed up and went, are you ready to get your hair washed? And she said, oh, yeah. And I said, okay, well, I'll try and find another Christmas story we might like. And she said, you don't have to find a Christmas story. I like any story. And everybody just stopped and stared at her and went, well, Mary, That's the most I've heard her say in a long time.
Oh, that's neat.
So,
yeah,
you know, every time is not so great, but I, doing it that one time, it was kind of like Bilbo trying to take that, it kind of established for him what he should try to do. I'm going to try to do it.
Wow.
You know, that was his first step. And that was, and for me, I was like, I feel so stupid saying this. I'm like, but I found it very inspirational.
Well,
I was very
thankful. Inspirational. It is.
To Tolkien for, yeah. You know, and to the neat. Tolkien.
You know,
professor.
It's funny how things fit together.
Yeah.
Because I'm reading, trying to keep up with In Conversation with God, something that I've tried before. So here's another attempt.
Mm-hmm,
you know, devotional. So I started on, you know, when Advent started and have right. been, you know, doing my best to keep up. And I read this, it was last Thursday, and I laughed out loud because it made me think of our talk about the paper last week.
Mm-hmm.
And Marissa Tomei, see, I can remember her name, Marissa Tomei.
Funny how that is.
Antonio Banderas, by the way.
Oh, really? Okay.
He's the lead in 13th Warrior.
That's
okay.
Interesting. Okay.
So anyway, I'll just read this out loud because it dovetails into everything you just said.
Okay.
And it also talks about pretty much the Hobbit.
Okay.
It says, the Christian life is simply not compatible with self-satisfied mediocrity, love of comfort, and lukewarmness. Some people, for his sake, would not even rise from a place which is to their ease and liking, unless by their doing so the sweetness of God came to their mouths and hearts without their moving a step and mortifying themselves by losing any of their useless desires, consolations, and pleasures. But until they leave these in order to seek him, they will not find him, however much they cry to him. Now is an especially good moment to ask ourselves how much we struggle against our own passions, defects, sins, and bad inclinations. This struggle is a violence used to fight your own weaknesses and miseries, a fortitude which prevents you from camouflaging your own infidelities, a boldness to own up to the faith even when the environment is hostile. Today, as yesterday, heroism is expected of the Christian, a heroism in great struggles if the need arises. Normally, however, the heroism will be in the little skirmishes of each day. And that line is where I stopped and laughed.
That is
because
perfect.
It was just like, wow.
Yeah.
So, last week we were talking about how she was talking about marriage specifically, you know, but it could be almost any struggle in your life, how you need to make that decision all the time. You're never going to have the great struggle, the giant moment. She was saying it's just going to be a whole bunch of little ones. And in her case last week, she was saying he was failing in the little moments, so he's going to fail in the big one. He's mm-hmm. going to fail in the overall one. So, but
and what we see in The Hobbit, as you were saying, is Bilbo's constantly having to strive through greater and greater little moments, but they're all little moments, you know.
Yeah.
Until he gets to things like when he takes the Arkenstone and then decides to give it to what's that guy's name? The guy of Dale, he's not the charismatic mayor. He's mm-hmm. the one who winds up running things at the end.
I know who you're talking
about.
You know
who I mean?
I do know
none
who
of
you
us
mean,
can
but yeah, there's no way I'm going
right
to remember.
Sorry,
Antonio Banderas.
Oh, I didn't know he was in this book. Okay, good.
Marissa Tomei, that's about all I've got.
Well, you know, but that guy. So,
Yeah,
so that he can stop the fight, so that he can try and fend off a war. Bard, that's his name.
Yeah.
Okay. Which is interesting because a bard sings usually. This guy doesn't sing, but since Tolkien's all about song. but he takes a bigger step. In fact, he says he takes the Arkenstone. He was promised a 14th of the treasure. He assumes that that's probably about worth a 14th, even though he knows it's the most prized part of the treasure. And he's gives it to Bard because he knows that the dwarves want it so much that they might bargain with him and it will give peace. And what does that mean he gets? It means he gets nothing. He doesn't want anything else. If it brings peace, he's fine with it. And I said, what about you? Well, I've had the adventure.
You know? Yeah, that was a neat moment.
Yeah, and it's he doesn't even care about that stuff anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he never really cared about the treasure, not the way the dwarves did. I mean, he'll go through moments where he will, but at the beginning, it was just kind of, he was kind of urged to do it, and he wanted to show them he wasn't a little grocer type guy bobbing on the mat, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And by the end, he isn't, but he doesn't care about that anymore because he's changed internally also.
Right.
But he's still not doing big things. You know, the War of Five Armies, he's got his invisibility ring on, doesn't he? And he gets knocked out.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, and they have to find him.
Yeah. He wakes up in time to take it off, and they're looking for the last time to find him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because he's a little guy.
That's another luck moments, though, isn't it? I mean, mm-hmm. It popped up at exactly the right time in order for that to work out.
Yeah, you know? And what is that line that Gandalf says to him at the end where about prophecies where it's kind of underlining the fact that it wasn't just luck. Where he says, all the prophecies came true. Here he goes. Mm-hmm. Then the prophecies of the old songs have turned out to be true after a fashion, said Bilbo. Of course, said Gandalf, and why should not they prove true? Surely you don't disbelieve the prophecies because you had a hand in bringing them about yourself? You don't really suppose, do you, that all your adventures and escapes were managed by mere luck, just for your sole benefit? You are a very fine person, Mr. Baggins, and I am very fond of you, but you are only quite a little fellow in a wide world, after all. Thank goodness, says Bilbo, laughing. And yeah. It's pointed up in, it's a similar comment is made not about prophecy, but about luck and how things are managed, where we think it's for our benefit because we only have a very small view of the world and we're fairly little in it. But the bigger picture is managing things in a different way. And that's Tom Bombadil, who I finally was able to understand more after listening to it. So I was forced to listen to all those songs.
Yeah, yeah.
And, they say, wow, how did you happen to be down here to save us from the Willow? And he goes, oh, well, chance it was, if chance you call it. You know, everybody in the book will say something like that. Evidently, the Tolkien professor's talking about that later. And he's like, you know, the people in the know in the book always go, well, that was pretty lucky. If you believe in luck, you know, all the time. So they always kind of acknowledge there's a higher power helping out.
That's right. That's right.
And that's the kind of thing we do. We're kind of on some level, you know, that there are certain things that are chance, possibly, because you don't know. But there are some other things where you go, this wasn't just lucky.
Yeah, when you look back on it and you're like, holy cow, yeah. That could have gone a whole lot differently had that not happened.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And you know
it. And I guess that's an obvious statement, but when you seem to be in the right place at the right time for another person or for yourself, you know, it's a remarkable thing. And you know that if you had taken a different way, that it would have been different.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and it's that stuff. It's like that one Futurama, which is about God, and God tells Bender that, you know, if you do it just right, no one knows you did anything at all. Bender says, oh, like if you burn down a place that you just robbed so nobody sees it. And God says, well, yeah, if you make it look like an electrical thing. And then the whole episode ends with that kind of crazy coincidence because God sent him back. Oh, yeah, so funny. It's that, and it's that kind of thing that that's why it's so hard to explain, and that's why I used to go, how do people know this? They say God did this stuff, but it just looks like coincidence to me, and it had to happen to me for me to go, okay,
yeah.
That was too much coincidence. It's impossible. Okay.
Yep. Sometimes, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Well, that's the, you know, the thing with the house and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and that's what I liked about this book is that kind of thing is put in there and you're not hit over the head with it. I mean, statements like that are made, but, you know, you don't have to pay any attention to them.
Yeah,
it's not at all. Pounded.
And Tolkien really disliked allegory too.
Yes.
He came out strongly. In fact, I think it was in the first lecture, the Tolkien professor kind of talks about what Tolkien thought of analyzation of literature in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, it's true that in Beowulf, there was a scene where there's a burglar that goes into a cave and steals something from a dragon.
I forgot that. Yeah.
But what does that mean? You know, what does that mean? Does that mean that Tolkien was saying something specific? Tolkien would say, no, you know, things influence other things. And, right. And that's just that. It's not that there's some huge, deep meaning in it.
Well, and actually, my husband and I have just been listening to this. I told you about Exploring Music, that classical music show where the guy will take themes or talk about different
things. Right, yeah, he sent me a link to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we're listening to a series called A Game of Pairs. And what he's doing is talking about two famous classical composers where one really influenced the other. For instance, the one I was just listening to before I came in here was about Schumann and Brahms. Hmm. Brahms was a student of Schumann's. And so what he'll do is he'll take something and he'll go, now listen to this theme. The one I really liked was Haydn and Beethoven, because you could really hear it there. He said, listen to what Haydn would do with the symphony, which he essentially invented the kind we listen to. He has this slow beginning. He does this. He does this. So he play most of it, or, you know, a whole bunch of a symphony, and you could hear all this. And then he goes, now, let's listen to Beethoven's Seventh Symphony. And you're listening going, oh, my gosh, I never know. How would I have ever known? These things are so similar. Hmm. But Beethoven took them and did his own thing with them. And so what he was pointing out is that when you're learning, of course, you emulate the people that you are learning from or that you admire, and their influence shows. But what happens is you break out of some of that form and it opens it up so that then your creativity comes in and you make it into something new.
Hmm. Yeah.
And that's when you're the expert. And that's when later you have the student and it continues in this chain. And when you said that, I was just like, oh, well, that's exactly what happened with Beowulf and Tolkien and all that stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And because people, and this is the thing that bothered me for a long time with The Lord of the Rings, is you'd read it and you'd think, oh, yeah, well, he had a horrible time in the First World War, and then World War II was happening while he was writing this book. And, oh, well, okay, he was just winding that stuff in there. And Tolkien would say, and did say, no. You may see similarities, stories repeat themselves in stories and for real, and we see these patterns. But you're free to see that if you want, but that doesn't mean it was written there.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly what he says. Fascinating stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Before we finish the podcast, I really need to read something out of this book because it profoundly influenced me. One of the questions as I was kind of getting back into Christianity, one of the things that I had a big problem with, or a hump that to get over, I know I talked to you about Joseph Campbell and all that.
Oh, yeah.
How, you know, somebody could say to me something like, well, why don't you pray to Zeus? Why are those stories wrong and this story right, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it was coming across this book, The Inklings, when it was first described to me from, it was a conversation between C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien that really was the key for me to move forward.
And it's so funny because it was for Lewis also.
Yeah.
This is exactly. That famous night conversation they and one other person had.
Exactly. So do you mind if I read it?
No, please do.
Okay, this is a page long. Okay, this is on Saturday, the 19th of September, 1931. C.S. Lewis has two friends over to dine with him. One is Tolkien, and the other is a fellow named Hugo Dyson. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Lewis had never underestimated the power of myth. Far from it, for one of his earliest loves had been the Norse myth of the dying god Balder. Now Barfield, and that's Owen Barfield, had shown him the crucial role that mythology had played in the history of language and literature, but he still did not believe in the myths that delighted him. Beautiful and moving though such stories might be, they were, he said, ultimately untrue. As he expressed it to Tolkien, myths are lies, and therefore worthless, even though breathed through silver. No, said Tolkien, they are not lies. Just then, Lewis afterwards recalled, there was a rush of wind which came so suddenly on the still warm evening and sent so many leaves pattering down that we thought it was raining. We held our breath. When really? Tolkien resumed, he took his argument from the very thing that they were watching. You look at trees, he said, and call them trees, and probably you do not think twice about the word. You call a star, and think nothing more of it. But you must remember that these words, tree, star, were in their original forms, names given to these objects by people with very different views from yours. To you, a tree is simply a vegetable organism, and a star simply a ball of inanimate matter moving along a mathematical course. But to the first men, to talk of trees and stars saw things very differently. To them, the world was alive with mythological beings. They saw the stars as living silver, bursting into flame in answer to the eternal music. They saw the sky as a jeweled tent, and the earth as the womb whence all living things have come. To them, the whole of creation was myth-woven and elf-patterned. This was not a new notion to Lewis, for Tolkien was, in his own manner, expressing what Barfield had said in poetic diction. Nor, said Lewis, did it effectively answer his point that myths are lies. But, replied Tolkien, man is not ultimately a liar. He may pervert his thoughts into lies, but he comes from God, and it is from God that he draws his ultimate ideals. Lewis agreed. He had indeed accepted something like this notion for many years. Therefore, Tolkien continued, not merely the abstract thoughts of man, but also his imaginative inventions must originate with God, and must, in consequence, reflect something of eternal truth. In making a myth, in practicing mythopoeia, and peopling the world with elves and dragons and goblins, a storyteller, or sub-creator, as Tolkien liked to call such a person, is actually fulfilling God's purpose and reflecting a splintered fragment of the true light. Pagan myths are therefore never just lies. There is always something of truth in them. And in the conclusion, he says, they talked on until Lewis was convinced by the force of Tolkien's argument. But he had another question to put to his friends, and as it was late, they decided to go indoors to Lewis's rooms on staircase 3 of new buildings. There, he recorded, we continued on Christianity. And that's page 43 and part of 44 of The Inklings by Humphrey Carpenter.
Okay, I'm going to have to read that book.
Yeah. So that when I read that the first time, that's what shifted gears for me. I was stuck.
It was a forceful argument for you too.
It was a forceful argument because it allowed me to be able to see that was possible. You know, it allowed me to believe that the Christian story could be unique and that a myth was not equal to it. You know?
Oh yeah.
So yeah. Up till then, and still there's a whole lot of people who believe, you know, that everything's just a myth. It's just one of many. But that argument allowed me to just believe that it's possible that this one's unique.
And what Tolkien said, right, was there, it is a myth. Christianity is a myth. It's the true myth.
Right.
And the others contain splinters of that light that's also reflected like that.
Right, exactly.
Which is, to me, the answer also of, you know, all these different religions, and they'll overlap in places. And I'm like, right, those are splinters.
Yeah, and it makes sense when you see it that way. You know, when they found the Dead Sea Scrolls, you know, in that story of Utnapishtim and the flood, and everybody said, aha!
You can see that
Christianity is a whole bunch of crap because obviously they stole this story from this and that. Well, not necessarily. If you look at it, it is even further evidence that something happened. Something really did.
That's what I was like, wow, that's exactly
when I heard it the first time, I was like, how remarkable is that? But, you know, so many people pointed at it and said, you guys are totally full of it because look at this, you know.
Well, and what they don't stop and look at ever is to read the details of the story that they're putting down and go, where's this story different?
Mm, yeah.
Because what the Hebrews people did with that story was say, here's the same story. Here's the focus we see it with. This is what it shows us of God and our relationship to him and the care he takes of people and what he wants of us and what we owe to him or don't, you know, whatever.
Mm,
yeah. It reveals something of their personality and of God's personality and those other, in a way that is unique compared to other people at the time.
Yep.
And so when I look at those and look at the differences and I'm like, wow, this is truly amazing.
Yeah.
Because you have to have read Genesis as many times as I have read that. No yeah. one wants to read it that yeah. many times, but
so.
but
anyway, thanks for letting me share that because that was a pivotal for me.
I love that story, but I've never heard it in that detail, so I appreciate you reading it.
Yeah, yeah. So it is a very good book, you know, and it talks about that. There's a fellow, you know, it's C.S. Lewis, J.R. Tolkien, and a fellow named Charles Williams, who I believe was also Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote books like called War in Heaven and things. I really ought to try
All
one
Hallows
of those.
Eve. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I never have read anything of him. I like C.S. Lewis quite a bit. I've read some of the Narnia things, and the Narnias are, you know, once you realize that Aslan is Christ,
right.
This is exactly what Tolkien disliked. You know, he was right. always like, I don't really like that. But
I'm more like Tolkien on mm-hmm. those. I mean, yeah. I did read the first one and go, okay, this has got more to it than I thought. But the problem I have is I came to them as an adult
mm-hmm.
and not as a believing adult. So I read through one and went, got it. Okay, put the hammer away now. Well, you know, it wasn't written for me. It was written for children. And to me, that's the extraordinary thing about The Hobbit.
Mm-hmm.
It was also written for children. And I think it doesn't have the Christ figure and that kind of thing because it's not trying to do the same thing, thank goodness, to me. But in thinking about it, reading it for this, which, as we both said, you know, that makes you focus on it in a completely different way. I was looking at things suddenly going, oh, we all have to leave our comfort zones or let ourselves be forced out of it, or we never reach our true potential. Otherwise, we're like the dwarves who never change their nature.
Mm-hmm.
Bilbo does. We're Bilbo. Bilbo's us. And did he write it like that? No, but that's there.
Yeah.
When we quarrel among ourselves, we're leaving room for something bad to come in. Whether it's the goblins or the dragon. And I realize this sounds like I'm forcing things, but when I was looking at it, I was going, in so many ways, this is how life works too. You know,
mm-hmm.
just the overall journey he takes. And especially once they got to Smaug, the way he would twist the truth just enough to make you doubt the people around you and turn you against each other and make you suddenly not look at all at what was really true. Just so discord could be sown.
Mm-hmm.
And that dragon gold sickness they'd have because they were so attached to the things. They yeah. couldn't detach themselves enough to look at the big world and the people around them and see what mattered.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, Tolkien may not have consciously been making that connection, but to him, that's what evil was. You know
right.
what I mean? So then
right.
you're going to create this evil dragon, and that's what you're going to have this evil dragon do because that's what you understand evil right. to be.
Well, and there are the different levels. The goblins are one kind of evil because that's their nature. They sing that song about, here's what we're going to do to you. You know, when you're working the mines, we're going to whip you and you're going to scream. It's going to be great. And Smaug is completely different. He wants to eat them all. But he's going to use devious cunning to try to confuse them.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, of course, later he's not above, you know, smashing into the mountain when he's really mad, but...
Yeah.
And then the thing of this is something that the Tolkien professor said. And I was this is when I started going, okay, and looking at the book for more than just the story, which I've always enjoyed, which he said, you know, what overcomes the trolls is their own evil tendencies, quarrelsomeness, hunger, hatred, which makes them unable to work together so they can be tricked. They're not defeated. They're tricked.
Mm-hmm.
But that which makes them evil is what leads to their downfall.
Right, right.
And they're not fighting against, they're not trying, of course, they don't have a reason to.
Mm-hmm.
They're very simple.
Yeah.
But, you know, the dwarves are like an extension of that upward. You know, their natures are described as being very concrete. And Tolkien, at one point, he goes, well, I'm not saying dwarves wouldn't, you know, help somebody, but they want to see what was in it for them, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the end, Thorin is very noble. He suddenly sees where he was wrong. He is suddenly the king under the mountain after he came out in the charge to help everybody in the Battle of the Five Armies. But it takes something extraordinary because he hasn't taken advantage of any of the opportunities along the way to gradually change the way Bilbo had to.
Right, right. Yeah. And, you know, like you said, I just love the subtlety of it. I mean,
it's just a great story.
It's a terrific story, you know, plus he's got this stuff woven into it that, you know, you and I just love. But at the same time, you know, he doesn't have, you know, well, this is your Christ figure and this is, you know, he's not retelling that. He's just, there's just Christian elements in it that are part of the story, which, you know, you can, it doesn't matter that they're Christian elements. And I just found an interesting quote by C.S. Lewis from one of his books that I think illustrates what his style is and how he's, well, let me just read it. This is from the Silver Chair. Piece of fiction. This is one of the Narnia books. Are you not thirsty? Said the lion. I'm dying of thirst, said Jill. Oh, then drink, said the lion. Would you mind going away while I do? The lion answered this only by a look and a very low growl. And as Jill gazed at its motionless bulk, she realized that she might as well have asked the whole mountain to move aside for her convenience. The delicious rippling noise of the stream was driving her nearly frantic. Will you promise not to do anything to me if I do come? Said Jill. I make no promise, said the lion. Jill was so thirsty now that without noticing it, she had come a step nearer. Do you eat girls? She said. I have swallowed up girls and boys, women and men, kings and emperors, cities and realms, said the lion. It didn't say this as if it were boasting, nor as if it were sorry, nor as if it were angry. It just said it. I daren't come and drink, said Jill. Then you will die of thirst, said the lion. Oh dear, said Jill, coming another step nearer. I suppose I must go and look for another stream then. There is no other stream, said the lion. And that's it. So you can see this is allegory. Mm-hmm. You know, the lion is Christ.
Well, and actually, you know, I was not being very nice about Lewis, about the Narnia books before, but when I was listening to them, I got the audio. I did much better listening than I did just trying to read them.
Was that Michael York reading those?
You know what? It's someone different reading each one.
Oh, really?
It's
really
great. Oh, and that's all wonderful.
Okay.
And that's why I got them from the library and I went ahead and put them all on a DVD because I was like, I have to give these back, but later on I'll finish them because they came in one huge set. So I was like, okay. And I got about halfway through and I was like, okay, that's enough Narnia for a while. I need something else. That's about three or four books.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, they were good that way. I did enjoy them, but what I enjoy of Lewis's is, to me, his masterpiece is the Screwtape Letters.
Oh yeah. Oh, I love
that
book.
And that's not the same thing at all.
It's not the same thing at all. But here you can see how different Narnia is from Tolkien.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, C.S. Lewis clearly has something that he's trying to do here. Right?
Yeah.
This is not him putting in, you know, like we were talking about Tolkien, this is what he thinks evil is, so therefore the dragon is going to have certain traits. This is the lion is Jesus Christ. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Jill is somebody who's searching, but is afraid to allow herself to be Christian. You know, so it's very,
this is that.
And it's very good. I really love this quote, but it's so different from what Tolkien is. Or what Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit are.
Well, and the thing that I love is they were such good friends. They each, you know, obviously Tolkien was very devout Catholic and, you know, solid Christian because, but so logical, understood how his friend thought both loved story and myth so much that they could communicate, so that when Lewis did take that huge step and started coming out in his writing, it just came out in just a completely different way, which is what some people want and need.
Yeah.
Both exactly. of them are fine. It's just for different things. And the thing I love about Lewis actually is he is so varied in the way he writes. I don't know how much of his stuff you've read, but
not a whole bunch. I've read some of his, you know, like Mere Christianity, which I thought was half good and half not so.
It's kind of, well, yeah, because it started off as radio talks done during World War II that were kind of turned into a book.
And a lot of that was really interesting. And then I thought, you know, it kind of fell apart. But some of the Narnia books I've read, and I think I read Out of the Silent Planet, which is one of his space trilogy.
I would like to read.
Yeah. Those. And then that was so long ago that it's a dim memory. So I would love to read those again, or that one again. I haven't read the other two.
But there's... I tend to like his nonfiction more, but when I say that, I'm thinking, well, The Great Divorce isn't nonfiction. It's allegorical also, but it's really different. I mean, it's for grown-ups, for one thing. So he's writing completely on a different level of understanding. And also that Till We Have Faces, that's his reworking of the myth of Psyche and Cupid.
Oh, mm-hmm.
It's so hard to understand some of it, but it's so amazing that I didn't even feel like I was struggling through. I just kept going, I don't understand this. I have to talk to my friends, but you know, who were all reading it. But it was really, I mean, so he wrote so many different kinds of things, because then he wrote Miracles and on the subject of and pain or whatever, and Surprised by Joy, which is part of his autobiography. And all those things are kind of written differently depending on the needs. So He was really very much of a writer, whereas I feel like Tolkien did good writing, but he wasn't first and foremost a writer. He was interested more in the research and the scholarly part of it. It's just my feeling. I don't know.
No, I feel like you're right. You know, Tolkien was a professor. Well, so was Lewis, but Tolkien wasn't trying to argue with people all the time, and
yeah,
you know, he was interested in language and mythology, and he was doing research and doing all this stuff, and this writing was almost like a hobby to him.
Yeah, yeah. The arguments he was having were with people about words, where he had this, and I don't really fully understand it, maybe when I read some more of this book, but Rose was talking about this too when she was talking about The Hobbit, the movie, but it was this thing of, he really felt like a lot of these myths reflected something that actually you could get back to the original stories based on the kinds of words that were used and how they were used. And it starts getting really, really complicated. And that's why the Silmarillion is so hard to read, because that's him really thinking on paper about all those very different kind of concepts.
Wow. Hey, I found something really interesting in this book. I just went to the index and looked up Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. Fascinating. It says, one day in early spring of 1949, Lewis began to read aloud to Tolkien the beginning of a new book he was writing. Once there were four children whose names were Peter, Susan, Edmund, and Lucy. Lewis said the immediate cause of The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe was a series of nightmares he'd been having about lions. On the deeper level, the story was, he explained, an answer to the question, what might Christ be like if there really were a world like Narnia? And he chose to be incarnate and die and rise again in that world as he had actually done in ours. Okay, and then it goes on to explain some more.
Okay, yeah.
The Narnia stories, therefore, are entirely in keeping with Lewis and Tolkien's shared belief that story, capital S, especially of the mythical type, can in itself give nourishment without imparting abstract meaning. They have, it is true, a far more specifically Christian coloring than does The Lord of the Rings. Indeed, at times, they have something very near a didactic purpose. But so do Out of the Silent Planet and Perelandra, and Tolkien had been extremely enthusiastic about those books. Why, then, did he totally reject the Narnia stories?
Yeah.
For reject them he did. Lewis told his former pupil, Roger Lancelin Green, who sometimes drank with the Inklings at the Bird and Baby, that after listening to the opening chapters of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Tolkien had said he disliked it intensely.
Whoa.
Yep. Why wouldn't it do? Tolkien was, by his own admission, a man of limited sympathies. He lacked Lewis's habitual urge to be enthusiastic about a friend's work simply because it was a friend's.
Mm-hmm.
He judged stories, especially stories in this vein, by severe standards. He disliked works of the imagination that were written hastily, were inconsistent in their details, and were not always totally convincing in their evocation of a secondary world. Interesting.
And when you think about it, yeah, even The Hobbit, which is much simpler, of course, than The Lord of the Rings, has a much richer and deeper feel than any of the Narnia. Well,
No question. You'd have a hard time coming up with anything that has a deeper and richer feel than Middle Earth.
Yeah, The Hobbit is just, you get this feel, and it's kind of, in some of it's in the way the narration is done, is, oh, if you'd only heard half the stories I've heard about Gandalf, we don't have time for those now.
Yeah.
You know, they'll,
yeah,
he'll break off and say, well, you know, most people already know this, but just in case you haven't heard of it, you know, right, he'll stop, and it's kind of just assumed.
Yeah, and all that backstory that he had.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
In writing things that I've been to, you know, in conventions and things, they always talk about world-building disease. They say, you can't be Tolkien, okay? Everybody's not Tolkien. You can't spend your life building up this world. You need to stop and write at some point, you know, talking to these wannabe writers.
I guess that's what the Silmarillion was, but that was just his, he wasn't trying to do it so he could write.
Yeah, Tolkien was unique. This was his hobby.
Yeah.
He loved it.
It was his passion.
He was satisfied doing what he was doing, and he made something great. So, you know, if somebody's happy just fiddling around in this world they've created, then by all means, go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
But,
well, one of the things I love, and this is something that I hadn't known before, but once you start looking at these books, then you see everybody mentioning it, and people haven't heard it, is the first version of The Hobbit from 1937 was very different in that Gollum was much friendlier. He still wasn't great.
The actual published one? They published a version that was different from this one?
Oh, yeah, until The Lord of the Rings came out. Until 1951 is when they went back and changed it, because
The
Lord of the Rings was going to come out.
Yeah,
this the beginning of my version of The Hobbit talks about it, and it says, because what happened is that it's a real different version of the riddles in the dark. And what happened is at the end, Bilbo wins and Gollum goes, well, okay then. And they shake hands and he brings in the ring. They go, okay, see you later. All right. You know, and he goes off with his ring because it's not the ring at that point. So in 51, so that was in 37. Mm-hmm. In 51, which was the second edition, although the fifth impression, so they'd reprinted it three times after that, I guess. There were four editions before it, or four impressions before it. It says it contains a significantly revised portion, which is more in line with the sequel. And then so then what they did is when they would talk about, oh, well, that's part of that story that, you know, that story that Bilbo told.
Mm-hmm.
So any inconsistencies in The Hobbit, they would kind of say, well, you know, that there is a version that Bilbo wrote that he published and people bought, and they think that's the real story, but that he was under the influence of the ring. And that's what that's what Tolkien would say about the 1937 version.
Oh,
and I was
that?
Like, I love that. Talk about consistency in world building. That is so great. That just charmed me to think of, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, poor Bilbo. He was lying even then. What can you do? You know?
That's funny.
I know.
Yeah.
Well, and we didn't talk about Gollum, and Gollum is a bridging character that's so important in both books. Well, he's very important in the second book, but in the first book, that is when you really see a lot about what Bilbo's like. He holds his own against Gollum in the riddle contest. I was really caught up, you know, you get caught up in the riddles and the game of wits.
Yeah.
And he suddenly says, oh my gosh, he hears this scream from this island. He's like, oh, that's it. He's going to kill me. Oh my gosh. What do I have in my pocket? I'm going to put it on, you know, and it slips on his finger. And, something I didn't think about, and again, this is, I'm sure it's in books and stuff, but the Tolkien professor kind of pointed it out when I was listening, is I didn't realize that each of the riddles that the different characters tell reflects their inner character also. Bilbo's are always about things like, you know, the sun shining on a daisy, your teeth because he's hungry. He's always hungry. And golems are about, you know, time, which is, and the description of time is that it withers everything and kills everything. And, you know, it's always the really dark stuff because that's where he lives and that's what he knows and that's what has crept into his soul. And it's that, you know what? There's something worse than being tortured by goblins. You could become like Gollum, where you've shut yourself off to the service of this thing so long without even realizing it. You can't, you're tortured by it, but you, but you're never happy.
Yep.
And so he's the opposite of Bilbo, who's always, yeah, he may always be thinking, I wish I was back in my hobbit hole. Well, I'll try and make myself feel better by thinking about bacon and eggs. No, that's not working, you know? And, but he's so solidly based in the things of life that instead of something that's more, what, ethereal or not as real.
Yeah, yeah.
And helping his friends and being connected to people. You know, he's not going to shut himself off down in the bottom of the mountain.
Sure enough.
Yep. And poor Gollum, I mean, he doesn't even, the most he ever sees of anybody is if a goblin gets sent down to get a fish and he kills the goblin so he can eat it.
Yeah, and that's got to be one of those things that Tolkien was really pleased with, that the ring itself wanted out of there.
Yeah.
You know, so he was like, oh, yeah. So the ring itself wanted out of there. You know, I'm sure that would have been a neat moment for him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that it itself had a personality, although it wasn't a creature itself. It was just that was part of its character.
Yeah,
to respond to the call of the master, which is to get out of there and closer.
Exactly.
Because the master had risen again. So.
Right. Well, fantastic. Good book, this one. Yeah.
So much. I know if you haven't read The Hobbit, and I can't imagine it, but I know that, like, this lady I ran into last night had not read anything by Tolkien. Yeah. And, I mean, The Hobbit is a great story.
Yeah, don't, you know, because it's fantasy or something, don't just discount it. It's really something else. Give it a shot if you haven't.
And it's very real. I mean, you know, like we were saying about these characters, you recognize this character type. You know, I mean, they're broadly painted, like the goblins and things, but still.
Right.
You know, and we didn't even talk about, you know, there's all these random people and they're like Bjorn, who's a one of a kind, a shape changer.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. That kind of thing.
There's lots in there. It's not as big as Lord of the Rings, but, you know, there's still, I mean, it's rich, really rich.
That's what I was going to say. It's a fairly short, it's maybe 300 pages, but it's a very rich book. And it's just, it's fun and it's satisfying. And I discovered it, I guess, in college probably.
Yeah, mine would have been high school.
Okay.
I still remember the cover. I kind of search around the internet for the cover of these Ballantine paperbacks.
Yeah, wasn't it that really horribly ugly?
Yeah, they each had a different color. The Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings, the three volumes, they all had a different color. I think Return of the King was red. The Hobbit was yellow and had a picture of an eagle and a nest on the front.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
the great eagles, didn't even mention them. Well, they weren't necessary.
Yeah.
But, I mean, because I loved them because they were very what you would think of as eagle-like because they hated the goblins and they hated the wargs, which was the evil wolves, but they weren't going to go out of their way. But if in the due course of things, they could, you know, do some bad to some goblins, well, that was okay. Yeah, very eagle-like, you think. You know, like, well, we're busy with our own eagle things. We don't have time for this.
Exactly. That's so right.
So, yeah.
How funny.
It's just a very satisfying book, and it's funny to me that I'm reading the book again because now to read it to me is more satisfying than listening to it.
Yeah. And that's, my daughter said, you know, while I was getting ready, she said, you know, you should read more to me, you know.
Oh, I'm that's like, neat.
Oh, okay, I will. What do you want to read? How about Lord of the Rings? So I know what I'll be doing for the next 2 years.
A long journey.
But
yes, you're going to have to just keep going with that until she either gets tired of it or leaves home because that's going to take a while.
Yep. It'll be fun.
Yeah. That's going to be great.
Yep. She's 12.
Okay.
Won't be long now. Yep. Got a little time. Got a little time.
Yeah. And the first book is my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
I love The Fellowship of the Ring.
Fellowship of the Ring. Yes.
I'm hoping listening to the other two will make me appreciate them more. Just like watching the movies made me appreciate the last two books more. Because there were some epic battles in there that I really enjoyed. Yeah,
you know, and I haven't read those books since the movies came out. And I've watched the movies several times, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's probably time for me to revisit those and see what's really
after
in there.
Yeah, after the movies came out, I had them, but I didn't have them with, Viggo Mortensen on the cover or Orlando Bloom. I'm just going to say it. I liked them, okay? Legolas was fine by me. And so we got the paperbacks with those on them, and I sat down and read them all and went, oh, okay, I can see it better.
Yeah, Legolas. You know, I'm sure that they've added some things to this, the Hobbit movie. You know, I've read a few reviews, but but Orlando Bloom was part of the shooting for this movie, so I wonder where he's going to be. I don't know that he's in this first one.
No,
but, I know that he was there for filming.
Yeah, Lee Pace from Pushing Daisies. I think he's Elrond, or. Hmm.
Elrond is the same guy who Elrond was.
Oh, Hugo Weaving.
Hugo Weaving, that's him.
Yeah. Okay, well, it seems like they'd be concerned. Oh, well, he's somebody then. He's some elf. Mm-hmm. Somebody like that. Anyway, whatever. I'll rent it eventually. But
We'll definitely go see it sometime over this Christmas vacation.
Oh, you're so much more dedicated than I am.
I can't say that's dedicated. I enjoy going to the movies. Yeah, now that I live in a place with a theater, see them a lot more often. It's like there's one almost within walking distance of where I'm at. So it's different from where I was.
Yeah.
So now I have the opposite problem. I say, what's out? I'm going to go to a movie tonight. And there's nothing.
There's a movie.
Nothing good.
Yeah. Well, that's a fun attitude.
Yeah. So
you can have fun.
Exactly.
Well, so now let's see. Do we have anything else to say about the Hobbit?
Nope. I think we're good. And it was fantastic. Thanks for reading it. It was fun.
Well, I'm glad you picked it.
Well, I almost picked Letters of Father Christmas, which are letters that J.R.R. Tolkien wrote for his kids every Christmas. And it's a really thin book. And I was really thinking, you know, what I really wanted to talk about was Tolkien. And I started to read that, and I was like, this is nothing like it, The Hobbit.
Yeah.
So remember, I was struggling, and then you said, "Well, what do you want to do?" And I said, "Well, The Hobbit." And he said, "Well, let's do that." So
you said everybody's going to do it. I'm like, "Well, so what?" That's okay.
That's all right.
We're glad to read it.
Glad we did. Glad we did.
Yeah, me too. Because of course, I may never emerge from this sea of Tolkien literature, but that might be okay.
That's all right. You bet.
Yeah.
You bet.
Well, so let's see. So next is...
Next week we have a short break.
Right.
3 weeks from now, instead of only two, is The Day the Earth Stood Still from 1952, I believe. Looking forward to that.
I'm pretty excited about
that. Yeah, that'll be fun.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, we're doing that book, right? Introduction to a Devout Life.
Yes.
Which is a departure for us. Hopefully some folks will be interested, but I certainly am. So we're going to do one of those now and then.
It is. And it's, I've been reading it, as I said, slowly. But I worked my way through those little 10 meditation things or whatever. Yeah. And I was surprised at how applicable it is. I mean, it was written in the late 1600s, I think.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things where I'm reading now and he's talking about prayer and I'm like, oh, that's good. Oh, You know, I was getting ideas and go, oh, thank you. Okay. Got it. Okay. This is good. I mean, it's very practical.
Right. Yeah. I'm finding the same thing. I'm really impressed by it.
Oh, so you started it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've started it. And, you know, the introduction where he's talking about why he wrote it. I mean, it sounds like somebody today could have said all that, you know?
Yeah, so. I know. I love the thing where he's like, I'm writing about the devout life, though I'm not devout myself. And I'm like, okay, now I know I can trust you. Thank you for saying that, because none of us ever feel that way, right?
Yeah, right.
So.
Yeah, really interesting.
Yeah.
So and good.
I'll have to pick out a movie, but that's for much later.
Yep, plenty of time.
Yep.
So, great.
Well,
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, yeah. Now you're staying wherever you are? Or
Yeah, well, you know, we usually travel around the region. So Trish's parents are about 45 minutes away. So on Christmas Day, we'll spend Christmas morning here, and then we'll off to Malad.
Okay.
And then that weekend following, we'll go up to Idaho Falls, which is about an hour and a half away, and stay with my sister for a couple days.
That'll be fun.
There and mess around up there.
Okay.
And that'll be about it. And then Chris will go back on the 2nd. My son Chris is coming in on the 22nd and then going back on the 2nd to college.
Okay. That's so fun. That's always fun. And yeah, Rose is coming in from LA on Saturday. And then we're just going to, you know, be here. Mm. So my mom's living in Florida and Tom's mom is here. And he's got three of his four brothers here. So
how's your temperature there?
It's actually, it's surprising. It was cooler. And so I liked it, but today was about 75,
80. Wow.
And everybody's walking around without their coats on going, wow, it's so nice. I'm like, I know. And then I went, oh, I've lived here a long time, I guess. Like, oh, none of that funny. Awful 40 degree weather.
So I'm looking up what we've got. Really cool. Well, yeah, it's about 20. It was like 25 degrees when I got home from work today. Oh. We finally got snow. So it's great. Yeah,
they
I love the seasons. You know, I say this every now and then, how cold it is here, but it's not miserable. I really like it. I like the seasons. You know,
I like the seasons also, except what I don't like is that with this kind of weather, it was cold for about 4 days, and I finally got to the point where I was putting on sweaters and always automatically wearing a coat, and now today I had to layer and not wear leave my coat at home, and I was like, you know, I can't get used to what I'm supposed to do.
Hi there, everyone. I'd rather have it just stay cold. Just Mark Thibodeau looking at the western edge of winter storm Draco.
Cold on Christmas, so we'll see.
You bet. Well, good. So you have a terrific one. And say hi to your family
Christmas.
For me.
Yep. I will. And say thank you to your family for giving you up on all these evenings.
And
I really
do the same.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, I do too. We have a good time. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And happy New Year. Everybody, you'll survive the New Year. Yes. And we'll see you back on, I guess, January the 10th.
That's right. Bye, everybody.
Goodbye. Take care. Thank you.